Hi, this is David Spray from the IC Disc Show. I am really excited to announce the interview with Neil Block of Baker & McKenzie. Neil Block is referred to as the godfather of the IC Disc. Neil has been doing IC Disc work since its inception in 1971, and he really has an amazing background on the IC Disc. The breadth of his knowledge and experience is just amazing and fascinating. He's really funny, engaging, and he just has one story after another about IC Disc over the last 50 years. I hope you enjoy listening to this interview as much as I enjoyed doing it with Neil.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, David.
So how are you today?
Doing fine.
Thank you for taking time to be on the IC Disc Show. So, well, let's just get right to it. I'd like to start out by just reading your bio, and then we can, if there's anything that I left out from the bio that you think's relevant to add, please add. Neil Block received his BS with high honors from the University of Illinois in 1964 and passed the CPA exam in the same year, receiving an Illinois Silver Medal and the Elijah Watt Sells Honorable Mention. He received his JD from the University of Chicago in 1967. He was admitted to practice law in the District of Columbia and Illinois in 1967. Upon graduation from law school, he served as an attorney advisor on the U.S. Tax Court from 1967 to 1969. And I believe you joined Baker and McKenzie in 1969 then. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Mr. Block was also an adjunct professor of taxation in the Master's in Tax Law program at the Chicago Kent School of Law from 1986 to 1990, where he taught a foreign taxation course. Neil is a frequent contributor of articles on the extraterritorial income exclusion, foreign sales corporations, and domestic international sales corporations. And he has had numerous publications. He's also published a book for Commerce Clearinghouse on the extraterritorial income exclusion and foreign sales corporations and domestic sales corporations. So is there anything else that we need to add that you think is important about your background?
Well, I just published the B&A portfolio.
Oh, that's right. Yes. So can you just talk a bit about that before we get started?
Yeah, I think I was chosen by default. The there was an export incentives portfolio primarily devoted to foreign sales corporations for quite a while. And I was asked a number of years ago if I would update it. And as it turned out, the update was needed for DISC rather than foreign sales corporations. And there was almost very little on that. So I got together all of my outlines and from the speeches I gave and articles I wrote and came out with the most recent version of the export incentives earlier this year. So it's hot off the press. It's the B&A portfolio 603, I believe it is.
Okay. Well, thank you for the reminder of that. Anything else about your bio that we should mention, or can we go ahead and get started with some of the questions I have?
I'm sure that the questions are more important than my bio.
Okay. So I'd like to start off with, just to kind of set the stage, I believe that a law professor of yours encouraged you to specialize. Can you just share that story of who that was and you know, what his thoughts were on that?
I wouldn't consider his encouraging me because it was a general comment that he made to a class.
Oh, okay.
Corporations and something, I don't know if he was looking at me, but he said something to the effect that you didn't have to be the sharpest tack in the shed in order to be successful if you could specialize in an area that nobody else knew about.
Okay.
And looking around, where I had all these ultimately famous people, I had John Ashcroft in my class who became the attorney general. I had a guy that had his own chair in California, at Berkeley. I figured maybe I ought to start specializing. So when I got off the tax court, the DISC was just being introduced, as a new tax regime. And I said, well, I might as well be on the ground floor and become a specialist in that area. And so that's how it started. I commented on proposed regulations and tried to learn as much as I could about the area. And I'd say for a long time, no more than 5 or 10% of my practice was in the DISC area, but I sort of stuck with it until I sort of got a name for myself and eventually had it as a major focus of my practice.
Okay. And so from then, so basically from the time that you joined Baker & McKenzie in 69, was the DISC legislation then already, were they already starting to talk about it? Because I don't think it was actually enacted until 1971. Is that correct?
That's correct. But it was being introduced, it was being talked about. And there was a predecessor called the Western Hemisphere Trade Corporation, which I wasn't aware of at the time, which was somewhat like the DISC. It provided an export incentive in a bit of a different manner, more of an arm's length transactional nature, but it was within the code itself.
Okay. And so you'd mentioned that you had the chance to have some input or commentary on the proposed regs. What were your initial thoughts on the DISC when you first started to read about it?
Well, since I was pretty naive, I had no idea of the fact that it was something I wanted to get interested in and try to know as much about it as I could. I wasn't politically motivated as to whether or not it made any sense. Wasn't sure it did because of the fact that I wasn't sure how much people were exporting or how much more they would export because of the DISC provisions. And interestingly enough, I never really tried to tout the fact that my clients were adopting DISCs so that they could have the incentive to export, because I really didn't know if they did or did not. And as
sure.
It turns out, even today, when we just had these SUMA cases, and we're jumping ahead, but with the DISC owned by a Roth IRA, we did not try to imply that the clients were incentivized to export because of the DISC provisions, because we just couldn't prove it.
Sure. Okay, well, that makes sense. And when this came online in 1971, could you have imagined that it would still be in existence 48 years later?
Well, of course, the answer is no. As a matter of fact, it's interesting because at the time, there were a number of us younger associates who were told to try to learn about areas that were becoming popular in the area, in the code, so that we could be up to date. And various tax provisions came in and left, and the DISC was always on its way out, but never quite made it out. Just to let you know, the DISC was introduced by the Ford administration as a Republican export benefit for the benefit of large and small businesses. A few years later, the Republicans decided to get rid of DISC, but the Democrats decided it was a good small business incentive, and so they decided they wanted to keep it in. And so every so often, the DISC provisions are designed to be legislated out and come right back in again. And most recently, the Tax Reform Act of 2016, the DISC was out in the Senate report. They were going to get rid of DISC, and then some of the senators refused to vote for the bill unless DISC came back in again. So it's still there.
Yeah, and I think you had mentioned to me before that one of the reasons that it seems like that there's not a lot of people that have really specialized in the DISC to the extent you have is because of this whole idea that, quote, it's going away. And like you just mentioned, it's been, quote, going away for 48 years now, hasn't it?
I would say within about every 5 years, there's something that's been proposed to get rid of it or change it dramatically. In fact, the big shift came in 1984. When the DISC was held to be in violation of the General Agreement of Tariffs and Trade. And that's when the Foreign Sales Corporation provisions were adopted in order to try to meet the DISC objections. But DISC was kept in as an interest charge DISC designed to help the smaller exporters who didn't want to go offshore. So in 1984, there was a substantial shift in the DISC provisions, but they stayed in the code, whereas the Foreign Sales Corporation came in and then ultimately in 2000 was phased out again.
Okay. Yeah. So one of the reasons I was really excited to have you on the show is because, you really had a ringside seat from the very beginning of DISC. And what I'd kind of like to do is really just kind of go through in kind of chronological order, through the history of the disc. And you had mentioned, you know, 1984, you know, was a major year because of, you know, the issues with the Foreign Sales Corporation. Was there anything before 84 that's, you know, that comes to mind, you know, any relevant things, or was the disc pretty quiet from 71 to 84?
Well, actually, from 71 on, there was a lot of litigation. There were, of course, there were proposed regulations, final regulations. There were amendments to the regulations, and there was litigation. Interestingly enough, while the most recent cases we were trying were substance over form cases, the service has always been trying to put more substance into the disc. And for the most part, the regulations that the service came out with were held invalid by the tax court. Just about all of the cases involving discs were tax court cases, except for the Caterpillar tractor case, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But basically, the disc was required to have its own bank account, and that was held to be invalid, or decided would be invalid. There were a number of requirements for discs to meet that the taxpayers challenged when they were found to be invalid. So if you look at the history of the disc litigation, a good portion of it involved validity of regulations. Some of the regulations were upheld. They weren't all generally attacked, but the certainly some of the ones in requiring more than a bare-bone structure were struck down.
Okay. And you're saying those happened over the course of several cases, you know, during those first 10 years or so?
I would say through the 70s, there were quite a bit of disc litigation.
Okay. And just to make sure I understand, so that the service was trying to basically force more substance to the disc,
yes.
And that the litigation, that much of the time the service lost that, lost in that that endeavor, but some of the times they were successful. Is that correct?
I think that is correct. In fact, one of the cases I tried, the Swanson Tool case, which was one that was in the IRA case, we went for attorney's fees on the basis that there was no reasonable basis for the service to take its position, and we were upheld on that basis. And one of the points made by the court was that the plain language rule had to be strictly followed in the disc area because of the fact that it was totally statutory.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. You had mentioned the Caterpillar tractor case, and was that also around 1984, about the same time as the Fisk?
No, it was in the early 70s.
Oh, it was that long ago. Okay, well, why don't we jump into that? Why don't you tell us about that case and, you know, kind of the significance of that?
Yeah, I had almost forgotten about it when we tried the other cases, but the Caterpillar tractor case involved a regulation which basically said that a WHTC, which was the forerunner of the disc, could not generate, I think, qualified export receipts to a disc with respect to its transactions with a disc, on the basis that the disc was intended to be a replacement for the WHTC and not work in tandem with the WHTC. And the Court of Claims, Claims Court, then the Court of Claims, held that the regulation was invalid, that there was nothing in the legislation of either the WHTC or the disc which prevented either one from using the other. And therefore, even though it was an assignment, basically an assignment of income, I mean, that's the phrase that the claims court used, there was nothing to prevent it. So that if you're looking for a history of invalid regulations in terms of transactions between two tax exempt entities, you'll find it in the Caterpillar tractor case.
And when did the Western Hemisphere Trade Corporation either cease to exist, or when did it fall out of favor?
Probably 72, 73. It was not too much longer after Caterpillar, I think, that the WHTC went out. And in fact, it might have gone out before the case was decided. I can't remember now.
Okay.
I haven't had a question involving the Western Hemisphere Trade Corporation for many years. So.
Okay, yeah. Well, I always try to ask you novel questions as I'm able to. So we had the Caterpillar tractor case. Were you involved in that case, or was that somebody else that was responsible for that?
I had nothing to do with the case itself, but I had a large taxpayer who had used the WHTC, and we were able to file amended returns going back to all the open years that we would qualify for, so that we were able to get all the benefits of the WHTC for that company. But I did not have the pleasure or responsibility for shepherding that case through.
So basically your client was able to benefit without having to pay any of the legal fees to get to that point. That sounds like a good outcome for your client.
Well, I think we paid charge them.
Understood. So after the Caterpillar case, what's the next maybe case that comes to mind chronologically that had significance, either your case or change in rules?
Well, I think what came about was in the late 70s, or maybe whenever the IRA provisions came into effect. I don't take responsibility for it. There was one of our employee benefits people got together with another tax guy, and they had lunch, and they sort of drafted out on a piece of paper having a disc owned by an IRA. And that was in the 70s or early 80s that the concept came through, and ultimately the service started challenging that after a while. But I would say in terms of my practice, that was the next big thing. I think it's important to note that initially the disc was the child of the large exporters. That was where the big money was, because the disc was designed to be a deferral vehicle, but unlimited deferral, and it was based on creating exports. And initially it was an unlimited deferral. Then they put in deemed distributions to cut back the benefit. But some of the biggest companies in the world, like Caterpillar Tractor and I know Pillsbury, when the disc got phased out, they were providing for income tax when the disc provisions were forgiven in 1984. They think they recognized about $3 or $4 special income item per share because
wow.
of the fact that they were forgiven all the tax. I think one of the other big things was, I think Caterpillar Tractor was responsible for the transaction by transaction rulings. Up to that point, almost everybody had grouped their transactions, and the Caterpillar case wasn't a case. It was really actually a revenue ruling that they got from the service saying that they could do transaction by transaction, which in most cases multiplied the disc benefit exponentially. Because
sure.
of the fact that you could now pick the best pricing method, 4% versus 50-50, and do that on a transaction by transaction basis. Now, not every taxpayer got a $1 billion benefit, but it did have ripple down effects so that most people could adopt it.
Sure.
That was the big difference. The big difference was the disc up till 1984. Before we'd started using it as a tax avoidance, permanent avoidance method through the shareholder-owned disc. But basically, because of the big players, the publicly held companies, it was basically a deferral vehicle. And companies were using it for that. And by 1984, you had companies such as Caterpillar and General Motors and other, like Microsoft. I think the biggest
Boeing,
user was Boeing,
maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. They had maybe $1 billion or more of deferred income in the disc. So in 1984, when the disc was held to be invalid under the GAAP provisions, the FISC replacement was widely promoted by all these companies, because under the disc replacement of the FISC, all the disc deferred income got forgiven. So any accumulated disc income in 1984 could be distributed tax-free, which was a big bonus. As I mentioned before, Pillsbury recognized a huge dividend or income shift, because they no longer had to provide for the tax.
Yeah, that's really amazing that you think about it, that there was a benefit or a ruling that resulted in just in billions of dollars of benefits to mostly Fortune 500 companies, right?
Yeah, I remember going to a meeting where FISC was being discussed, and the guy from one of these big companies said, I don't really give a damn what's in the legislation as long as we can get that money back tax free.
Sure. Yeah, he'll worry about that later. But let's capture that deferred income tax free. Okay. So that was early 80s, and then what was the next kind of significant case or event? Was this the Bluebird case? By now, or was there something else that comes to mind?
Well, I'd have to go back to search my memory as to what other significant disc cases there were. I would have to go through the literature. My involvement was primarily through the IRA, and the offshore ownership of discs got to be more and more popular. Although the offshore ownership of disc, we had one case that we got docketed and then settled it, but never really has percolated as anything the IRS has definitely attacked. So the IRA case is one where they've always been adverse to the idea of having a disc owned by another tax-exempt entity, similar to the Caterpillar Tractor case. So I got involved with basically the IRA structure, and that was challenged by the service constantly. And the Bluebird Body case was in the late 80s, I guess it was, I'm trying to remember, 86, 87. And that was a case where we had a disc owned by a qualified profit sharing plan. And at that time, the disc dividends could flow in the plan tax free. And what the service tried to do is disallow the disc commission on 482, section 482 grounds, even though the code and regulations said you could not apply 482 to disc commissions. And then ultimately they conceded that case in the tax court, but then legislation was introduced and section 995G was implemented, which provided that disc dividends were to be subject to UBIT tax or unrelated business income tax, which had not existed before.
So when that happened, then did you think that was going to be kind of the resolution to the IRA owned disc, that as long as the IRAs were willing to pay the UBIT tax, that it'd be kind of smooth sailing?
Obviously, I did, and that lasted a couple of years until the service decided that they would, that the disc provisions, that the 995G was not dispositive. And I think it should be noted that the DISC and the IRA structures were never intended to necessarily go together. They're just two pieces of legislation that happened to fit. But in executing the IRA structure, you had to make certain that you did not have prohibited transactions or do things that you weren't allowed to do with qualified plans. And if you did them, you could disqualify the plan and disqualify the DISC. So there's always the possibility of doing something wrong. And the next case that we had was the Swanson Tool case, in which the service took the position that while they couldn't make a 42 adjustment, they were going to treat the disc transactions as prohibited transactions and therefore disqualify the IRAs on that basis.
Okay.
Now, the interesting thing about Swanson Tool is, similar to the Bluebird Body case, by the time when the case came up for submission to the court, the service conceded the Bluebird Body case. The same thing happened in the Swanson Tool cases. When it came time to submit the case for decision, the service conceded the case. But my client didn't want to pay any more fees unless we could recover attorney's fees, so I filed a motion for attorney's fees in that case. And we fortunately were able to meet the requirements for attorney fees qualification.
And that's amazing.
The Swanson Tool case came out. It was not a decision for the taxpayer because we'd already won the case. The only issue is whether or not the service had a reasonable basis for its decision. And therefore, we were awarded attorney fees on the basis that the service did not have a reasonable basis for its position that there was a prohibited transaction. So that's how we won attorney's fees on that case. And the case itself, of course, has been cited for the proposition that you can't have prohibited transactions on the payment of disc commissions or receipt of disc dividends. But if the truth be known, it's not a case where we won the case because the service conceded it.
So is that, I can't imagine it's very, you know, that it happens all the time that you can get the service to pay attorney's fees. Is that a somewhat unusual circumstance, or does it happen, or is that something that happens frequently?
It happens more against the taxpayer than against the government.
Oh, really? Okay. Okay.
So a lot of the frivolous cases, the tax protester cases, what have you, are ones where attorney's fees get awarded against the taxpayer, where to get them against the government, it's a little bit more unusual.
Yeah. And I'm just curious, when the taxpayer has to pay attorney's fees, how's that calculated? Because I would assume that most of those attorney's fees are just, you know, the in-house folks at the service.
There's a rate that they use.
Oh, okay.
And in fact, the rate that was applied, recovered attorney's fees, was a substantially lower rate than our normal billing rate.
Oh, I see. So it's like the same rate, regardless of which side wins. It's a formulaic calculation.
Right. Of course, we were more interested in the attorney's fees for the taxpayer than what the government could recover. But basically, it's like a frivolous penalty provision for the taxpayers.
Okay. And then, so what comes to mind next? I think, was there a Jet Research versus the commissioner case?
Well, those cases came down. Basically, the Jet Research and the, I forgot the other one, but the...
Is that the Addison?
Addison, yeah. They were basically two sides of the same coin. One, the taxpayer was contending for, and the other was the government. The question arose in those cases as to whether or not what you did with the disc after it was disqualified. And the taxpayer, and I believe it was Addison, wanted the entire disc disregarded, and the commission reversed, whereas the government said, well, you paid the commission and we didn't make any 482 allocations, you're stuck with it. And then the court upheld that. So the answer was that you have to be careful. If you pay a disc commission and you don't reverse it timely, you could end up having to pay tax in a company you have no intention of using for tax purposes. The Jet Research case was just the opposite. It was one where the taxpayer didn't qualify and the government was trying to take the entire disc commission and put it back into the related supplier. But it was a buy-sell disc, and the court held that even though it was disqualified, it's still a corporation and entitled to 482 pricing. So I think the court left 10% of the income in the company. But basically, both cases said that you cannot apply substance over form to either a qualified disc or a disqualified one.
Hmm. And in those two cases, and I don't believe you were involved in either of those. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So, kind of staying in the sequence, because I think those cases were in the 90s. Is that right? For Addison and Jet Research,
they were
late 80s.
Yes, they were there. In fact, we were relying on them when the tax on the Roth IRA started. The Swanson Tool case was a traditional IRA. But the next case that came up was interesting about Swanson, by the way, is there was a disc and a FISC in that case, and the FISC was also being used for IRA purposes. It's sort of gotten lost in the shuffle, but initially the IRA concept with a disc was not a disc, was with a foreign sales corporation and with a disc, but the foreign sales corporation was used more readily than the disc was. So in the Swanson Tool case, there was a disc and a FISC owned by an IRA. And that case involved actually, as a tangential issue, the 995G UBIT income being imposed on the disc.
But not on the FISC.
Disc dividends. Well, UBIT was never imposed on the FISC. The FISC always paid its own tax. The way the FISC worked was it was like a regular foreign corporation, but 16/23 of its income was tax exempt, and 8/23 was effectively connected income with the U.S. trader business. So when you paid a commission to the FISC, you got a deduction for 16/23 of the of the commission, I guess it was, and A23rd got tax and risk got remitted tax free.
Okay. Well, that is an interesting side.
I might have my numbers mixed up. It's been a while since I did the math, but basically that was the point, is that a portion of the corporation's tax was exempt from U.S. tax on remittance. But the FISC only benefited corporations because the dividends received deduction that you got on FISC dividends only applied to U.S. corporations.
Okay. And C corps at that, I guess, right?
Yeah, at all times, the DISC was a C corporation. The FISC was a C corporation, although the FISC had to be located in a qualifying jurisdiction outside the United States, commonly the Virgin Islands.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then when we go kind of to the next significant case, does that bring us to Helweg, or was there something, any other cases that come to mind that had some, you know, significance?
I have to think. I really didn't do a survey of all the DISC cases that came down, but our next big case was the Helweg case, where the service decided that they'd already lost in 482. They'd lost on sort of substance over form. They'd lost on just about everything else they could think of. So they decided that they'd go after the excise tax. And what they did is they said that even though the DISC commissions were deductible for income tax purposes, the excise tax was a different animal, and you could not apply safe harbor rules to excise taxes that you could apply to the income taxes. So in the Helweg case, they allowed the deductibility of the DISC commissions, but they held that there was an excise tax due for an excess contribution because you could not apply the DISC provisions to the excise tax provisions.
Hmm. Okay. And then, so could we maybe just back up a little bit? Because I know this one, you know, this has a lot of significance as it relates to SUMA, I believe. So on that Helweg case, you got involved, like, I guess, when it was audited, or were you involved in the initial structuring of their DISC?
Well, we had Helweg, and we had another case called Oshman, O-H-S-M-A-N. And Helweg was one, I believe, that we instituted ourselves. I mean, from the ground up, we organized the DISCs and the Roth IRAs. We didn't organize, but we worked with the custodians. The Oshman case was one that was referred to us. And the Oshman case was a foreign sales corporation case owning a Roth IRA. And the same result was that they allowed the FISC commission, but they didn't allow the constructive contribution to the Roth IRAs. They held that was an excess contribution in both cases.
Okay. So could you just, I know we've kind of went through that Helweg case, you know, kind of quickly. Could we just, you know, maybe take a step back? So what year, do you remember what year the legislation or the litigation started on the Helweg case?
Let's see. I think we got 2000. I think, I'm trying to remember. I think 2011, or I think is when it was finally decided. I don't have it right. I can grab it, but I think that's when the case finally came out. Incidentally, just about all the cases that we've tried have been fully stipulated. I think all the DISC cases were fully stipulated. We did not have to have any testimony presented at trial. Everything came in as a fully stipulated case.
Could you, pardon my ignorance of that legal term, can you just describe more what fully stipulated means?
Sure. In every case, the parties are supposed to stipulate the facts that are not being litigated or agreed facts.
Okay.
So if you have a fully stipulated case, that means both parties agree on the essential facts of the case. And
okay.
The court can decide the case based on the stipulated facts rather than having to find facts as a matter of evidence.
I see.
Now, I guess
tell me about that.
Okay, because it's the standard of review of a fully stipulated case means that the reviewing court reviews the case what they call de novo. In other words, the reviewing court is not bound by any of the decisions of the court below it.
Okay.
Whereas a case that has evidentiary facts, the reviewing court must accept those facts as found by the lower court unless clearly erroneous.
Oh, that is really interesting. So let me just make sure I understand this. So on the, when you have a fully stipulated, is that the term?
Yes.
So when you have a fully stipulated case, when it goes up a level, it becomes a de novo case in which the evidentiary items are not taken into account.
Did well, the, all evidentiary items are deemed stipulated. In other words, for example, just as an aside, in the Summa case, we stipulated with the IRS that the taxpayer's basis in the DISC stock, I mean, the IRA, the Roth IRA's basis in the DISC stock was book value. We stipulated with them. That then came up later on in a companion case that we were not part of. We talked to the attorneys, called Mazzei, M-A-Z-Z-E-I, in which the tax court found that the was a shared FISC situation was improperly valued, and therefore they considered the owner of the FISC stock to be the related supplier rather than a Roth IRA. In our case, we'd already stipulated that the DISC stock was owned by the Roth IRAs, and we also stipulated what the basis was. And therefore, the Summa cases were distinguished from the Mazzei case on the basis that that was not an item in issue. And this was cited by all three courts that came up on appeal, that they were not going to address whether or not the stock was properly valued because it was not an issue in the case. And because it was stipulated, they could not go behind it.
Oh, that is very interesting. Well, I know I've been chomping at the bit. Is it time to get into the Summa case? To me, this case is just so fascinating. If there's nothing else, let's get into the Summa case.
Okay. Well, of course, the Helwig case. Okay. I think we should point out that the Helwig case was decided in favor of the taxpayer, and that the court held that basically the as long as you got a deduction for income tax purposes on the DISC commissions, that the service was prevented from finding an excess contribution to the Roth IRAs.
Okay.
So that's the holding of the Helwig case. Interestingly enough, it was the last case that Judge Nims decided, who retired from the tax court immediately after our case was entered. And the handwriting on the wall was that the case was issued as a memorandum opinion of the court rather than a what they call a published opinion of the court. The significance is not as great as it used to be, but basically when a decision is issued as a tax court decision there in the tax court volume, it has greater precedent than if it's issued as a memorandum opinion. Memorandum opinions are considered to have less precedential value than published opinions, even though they can be cited as precedent.
Oh, really?
And when the Helwig case and the Oshman case had the same result, we were surprised that they didn't come out as published opinions, but as memorandum opinions. But I think the reason for that was when the next case came up, which was the Summa case, the Helwig case was not as binding precedent as it would have been had it come out as a tax court opinion. So we think now that even after the Helwig decision came out, there were certain judges that would have made more of a fuss about it than they did, because Nims was retiring and that was his decision and they probably just let it go. So ours was the next case up, which was called Summa Holdings, Inc. And Summa Holdings, Inc. then became the next case up, where the service, unlike the Helwig case, the service for the first time argued that you could not pay a DISC commission where the DISC was owned by an Roth IRA on substance over form principles.
Okay.
And so that was what they did in the Helwig case is they accepted the DISC commission as giving rise to DISC benefits. In the Summa case, they took the position that there never was a DISC commission, that the entire commission could be reallocated as a constructive dividends to the related supplier shareholder and then a constructive contribution to the Roth IRAs.
Hmm. Well, could you just kind of back up? Like, do you remember the year that the Summa started? I think it was like, was it 04 or 05 that they had their first years that they used it?
Yeah, I think 2002 was the first year that the Roth IRA structure was put in place in Summa, and we were involved in the structuring of the company. People ask, okay, what's the difference between litigation and planning? And I said, one's before the fact, one, the other one's after the fact. I mean, you're always planning. So in this case, the we had the structure set up, and we did things the right way. We had the Roth IRA. We set up the Roth IRAs. Roth IRAs then formed the DISC, and they dropped the DISC stock and put the DISC stock in the Roth IRAs. We also had a holding company. So maybe it was the Roth IRA formed the holding company. The holding company formed the DISC. It didn't really matter, but the point was is that everything was done internally. And by the way, just you cannot transfer property into an IRA. You can only transfer cash. So if you're going to and have your IRA make an investment, it's got to invest cash. So you cannot transfer stock into a Roth IRA because that would be an invalid transfer of assets.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good to know. I'm sorry. I was just trying to make sure I had the chronology. So they started using this in about 2002, and then several years later, the IRS audited them or notified them that they didn't agree with their approach.
They were audited from time to time. Now they were around when the Helwig case was decided, and so it wasn't their turn yet, so to speak.
Okay.
And interestingly enough, the only years they picked were the open years, 2008. Even though there were no excise tax returns filed, but they took the same position in Summa as they had in Helwig, except for the fact that, unlike Helwig, they were now disallowing the DISC commission.
Okay. And so then your initial argument then, or what was your response then to that when they were disallowing the commission?
Well, our official response was that they couldn't do it. Our unofficial response was a little more emphatic.
Okay.
We felt that by this time they'd lost every single argument they made, and they were still attacking the structure. And now they're attacking the DISC commission, which seemed to be fairly straightforward. The DISC commission is provided for by statute.
And right.
There are no exceptions for the DISC commission being deductible and being income of the DISC. And so their position was that there never was a DISC commission. And it took us a while to figure out why they were saying that. But their position was that the Roth IRA limitation provisions were being abused, and in substance, because the DISC didn't do anything, there was nothing more than a constructive dividend from the related supplier to its shareholders, and therefore, they never imposed the gift tax, but they took the position that whether or not there was a gift tax, there was a constructive contribution by the beneficiaries of the Roth IRA to the Roth IRA. I should point out that in both Helwig and in Summa, what you really had is disproportionate ownership involved. You had the father who had owned the stock of all the stock of the related supplier, and the children owning the DISC stock, which then went into the Roth IRA, so that the ownership of the DISC was not the same as the ownership of the related supplier.
And why did that bother the service? Because, that's allowed for. I mean, there's no statutory prohibition, is there, that the ownership of the DISC have to be the same as the related supplier?
Well, because their problem was not so much that they had, years before they had, when you talk about use of the DISC as being a deferral device, it was always accepted, or pretty much from the very beginning, we did it, is if you had the DISC stock owned by the shareholders of a C corporation, you could avoid corporate tax on the DISC commissions.
Okay.
So you had a C corporation, and it's really closely held because you couldn't do that for publicly held, but if you had a C corporation owned by X, Y, and Z, and then X, Y, and Z owned stock of the DISC, and X, Y, and Z were individuals, the DISC dividends, the DISC commissions were deductible to the C corporation, and the DISC dividends became taxable solely to the shareholders, and you avoided corporate taxation.
Sure.
And the service issued a number of private letter rulings and pronouncements, GCMs, what have you, accepting this result, even though it was clear that this was being done solely to avoid income tax.
Hmm. So then what happens next with SUMA then? Because I know that, you know, there were several appeals, and so just kind of help me understand the sequence. So the service was making their argument, you disagreed, and then what happened next?
Well, we argued that the result under Roth IRA had to be the same as under traditional IRA. I don't want to get into more of the details, but the tax court accepted that rationale and said that the Helwig case really didn't get into the nuts and bolts of the ownership of the disc and the ability to disallow the disc commission, because everything was accepted by the service, and that because of the Roth IRA limitations on contributions being $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000, the disc commissions were a abuse of those limitations, and therefore were violative of Congress's intent and should therefore be disallowed as commissions to the disc, okay, and rather be treated as constructive dividends.
Okay.
And that's what's, and so the make a long story short, or not make it as long as you want it, but the tax court sided with the IRS and said, yes, you're correct that this is a this is an abuse and therefore should be disallowed. And rather than having disc commissions, we had constructive dividends to the shareholders of the related supplier, and then excess contributions by the children of the owner of the company as excess contributions to the Roth IRAs. And that's what set up the three appeals.
Gotcha.
It turned out that the related supplier, SUMA Corporation, is located in Cleveland, Ohio, and files its tax return there, and therefore became a Sixth Circuit taxpayer.
Okay.
The majority owner of the company, a guy named Jim Benenson, is a resident of New York, and therefore was in the Second Circuit. His children, James III and Clement, lived in Massachusetts, and therefore the excess contributions to the Roth IRAs were deemed to be made by them and taxable to them, and they were in the First Circuit.
Okay.
So we wanted to go to Sixth Circuit, but the IRS insisted that the case be appealed to all three circuits that had jurisdiction over the individuals. So we had to file the appeals in the First, Second, and Sixth Circuits.
Okay, so that's why that you had the three different appellate court processing or processes going on. So which one was decided first?
Well, the first was one we frankly wanted to get decided first, was the Sixth Circuit case, because the Sixth Circuit had decided the Addison International case, in which they held that there could not be substance over form to a disc. We thought that would be the best place to go. So we appealed the case to the Sixth Circuit first, and then to the First and Second Circuits.
And what happened in the Sixth Circuit then? What was the
happened? One, since we were in the Sixth Circuit, we asked to have the other two circuits postponed until the Sixth Circuit handed down its decision.
Okay.
And interestingly enough, the First Circuit said that they would do so, but we had to stipulate that we would be bound by the Sixth Circuit's decision. And so we agreed to that. And then the First Circuit, which initially didn't buy the argument, the Second Circuit realized the First Circuit was going to postpone the case, they agreed to postpone on the same basis that if we agreed to be bound by the Sixth Circuit's decision, they would postpone hearing the case. And now, if you want a war story, as an aside, when I went before the Second Circuit, we'd already won the cases in the First and the Sixth Circuits. And the chief judge said to me, Mr. Block, she says, "Yeah, just don't put on your high hat. We know darn well that if you would have lost the first two cases, you'd be right here trying to get a split of the circuits, just like the government is." And I said, "Well, no, that's not true, Your Honor." She said, "Why is that not true?" I said, "Because we stipulated we'd be bound by the Sixth Circuit. And if we were lost in the Sixth Circuit, we couldn't come before your court." So, brownie point for us on that one, I guess. But anyway, So the Sixth Circuit did get briefed and argued before the First and Second Circuits.
Okay, and then so the and then the findings or the ruling of the Sixth Circuit then was what?
The Sixth Circuit unanimously found that for the taxpayer, for us on our side, that the statute was clear. There was no basis for departing from the statute. There was nothing to prevent a Roth IRA from owning stock of a DISC, and basically adopted the position we had in the tax court, saying that there was nothing wrong with what we did, and therefore there was no constructive dividend to the shareholders and no excess contributions to the Roth IRAs. And we thought that based on the Sixth Circuit's decision, we probably won the case in the other two circuits because the Sixth Circuit addressed every issue that was before the other circuits.
Mm-hmm.
We were wrong.
Okay.
We lost on and the other two courts, we lost on that, saying that, you know, nice try, but we're gonna decide both your case on the merits, just like the Sixth Circuit decided on the merits, and ultimately that we won in both circuits, so it didn't matter. But when you look at the opinions of all three circuits, you'll see they were on the merits of the case, not on what they call stare decisis or res judicata, which is basically under the law you can't have the same case tried twice. And so if I win a case in the First Circuit and I have the same issues and I'm the same taxpayer in the Sixth Circuit, I'm going to get the decision of the Sixth Circuit too, because they're not going to depart. They call that res judicata.
Okay.
So, but we couldn't get race because the company was in one circuit and the father was in another, and we couldn't prove that we had common ownership. Make a long story short, each taxpayer had to prove up his own case, even though each taxpayer's case involved the issues that were before the other circuits.
Okay. And which circuit had the ruling where the judge really seemed to give a dressing down to the service, and there was the Caligula reference? Was that the First Circuit or the Second Circuit?
Well, the dressing down came in the First Circuit.
Okay. And
the Caligula reference came in the Sixth Circuit.
Oh, okay. Okay. And so can you just talk a bit about... Go ahead.
Okay. Well, the judge in the Sixth Circuit has a reputation for being sort of flamboyant and very high, good reputation. Jeffrey Sutton's his name. And one thing I'll say is that the pedigree of all the judges that we had was really top notch. I mean, I could not say that we were getting, when I get into the current judicial appointees, but I can assure you every judge that we had was thoroughly vetted by the Senate. All U.S. Court of Appeal judges have to be approved by the Senate, and they have special committees for that purpose. And for the most part, up to that, these judges were all approved on basically not nonpartisan, but certainly on a judicial qualification standard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even Judge Sutton got turned down once before he was finally approved, and he's a first-class judge. But every judge we had was first quality. As a matter of fact, in the Sixth Circuit, Judge Sutton's predecessor, who was a retired judge recalled for active duty, was also on our panel. So it was.
Wow.
So when you looked at the, I think one of the judges we had in the First Circuit had tried the case of John Gotti when he was a district judge. So.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
So, now the second court and the first courts. Did they also issue unanimous opinions?
No.
Okay.
We had 8 out of 9 judges vote to reverse the tax court. The 9th judge was in the First Circuit, which is the same circuit that dressed down the tax court. It's interesting enough. But the dissenting judge in the First Circuit was the chief justice of the Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. Highly respected. I said all the judges were, but she did not care for our case and was more sympathetic to the tax court decision. Mm-hmm. One getting all the differences, but she's the one who, of course, was the chief judge of our session. And by the way, Jim. Cosby, Bill Cosby's case was also on the same docket.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
So So I can't say that the Pat Court was for our case, but
understood. So you had these favorable rulings from all three circuits. So does that mean?
But the point was is that the First Circuit majority is the one that told the tax court that the that the Roth IRA provisions, having adopted the same rules as the traditional IRAs, was bound the tax court to make the same finding for the Roth IRAs that would have made for the traditional IRAs.
Which is why it goes back to the Helwig case, right? Because the Helwig case refers to the traditional IRA. Or did I?
No, Helwig was a Roth IRA.
It was. Oh, okay.
Let's go back to 1998. Before 1998, I can't remember when the IRAs were introduced. The IRA was the only IRA that you could have. But then in 1998, okay, the Roth IRAs were introduced in order to provide for what they said was a greater incentive to save, because the Roth IRA allowed you to pull all your money out at the age of 59 and a half without any income being recognized. Whereas a traditional IRA, you have to recognize income on the distribution of the IRA proceeds.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification. So now that you've prevailed in all three of these courts, I guess it's a done deal now, right? I mean, the Roth IRA is on disk is just bulletproof, no issues, no risks. Is that accurate?
No.
Yeah, I kind of figured that'd be the answer. So what's the wrinkle? What's the wrinkle in it?
Well, there's two things. One, each circuit only is binding for the courts in its own circuit. So the Sixth Circuit has, for example, Ohio and Michigan, and the First Circuit has Massachusetts and, I don't know, Maine or a couple other states. And then the Second Circuit has New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, I guess.
Okay.
Not Pennsylvania. But the point being is that those are the only decisions that are binding. There's nothing before the Supreme Court, but any other circuit can decide to go along or not. As a practical matter, you might say that it's pretty much settled, but there's another case out there called Mazzei, M-A-Z-Z-E-I, and I made slight reference to that, and that's the case where the issue was who owned the disk stock. And in the foreign sales corporation area, there was a thing called a shared FISC, which is designed for little tiny taxpayers to own a foreign corporation without having to spend a lot of money on it. And okay, so for 500 bucks, you could buy an interest in a shared FISC, and if a shared FISC could have 30 shareholders. So okay, that basically each interest was treated as if it was a separate foreign corporation. But the FISC itself didn't have any substance, and it was basically a gimmick in order to allow people to have it. But in the Mazzei case, the court held that because the shared FISC was purchased, not originally incorporated, that you had to look to see whether or not the proper valuation was placed on the stock and who got the benefit from the valuation. And the tax court held that in that case, the related supplier would be deemed to own the disk stock, not the, the FISC stock in that case, rather than the Roth IRA.
Okay.
Now, FISC is dead, and the shared FISC was unique to the FISC. It doesn't exist in the disk area. But they did raise the issue as to whether or not the proper valuation was paid for the FISC stock. Now, that was a purchase in that case. Ours was original issue, which is a different animal, and the tax court differentiated between original issue from purchase. But the fact is, all the courts of appeal made reference to the fact that we had stipulated our case, and it wasn't stipulated in the Mazzei case, so... Yeah, it's sort of still out there.
Okay, so has the Mazzei case not been settled then yet or resolved?
No, the Mazzei case was decided in favor of the government on the basis that the true purchaser of the FISC stock was the related supplier or its shareholders. They didn't decide which one, but in any event, okay, there was no FISC benefit. There was a constructive dividend. Not a constructive dividend, but the FISC was actually owned by the shareholders, and therefore the FISC dividend did not go to the IRA. It went to the individual shareholders. And that case is on appeal to the Ninth Circuit.
And is this a case that you're arguing?
No.
Okay.
I've been in touch with the attorneys, obviously, on the case, but it is not our case.
Okay. So is it safe to say then that if a taxpayer is in the First, Second, or Sixth Circuit, that their position is conceptually superior to a taxpayer that's not in one of those three circuits? Or for practical matters, is it? Okay.
But I know of no cases that are pending in any other circuits.
Okay. So,
And in fact, I've had other cases conceded by the government with the same issue. So I would say that the probability for success with the Roth IRA structure now is very high.
Okay. So what do you then, so say somebody, you know, comes to you, you know, a potential client and says, yeah, we're interested in this Roth structure. What are your thoughts, Neil? You know, should we do it? Should we not do it? Or, you know, how might you, you know, answer, you know, such a question?
Okay. Well, first of all, since we're going to have a future session, there are other disk structures that are available and may or may, so that the Roth IRA structure may not be the structure which is the best for the individual taxpayer. But I would say is that if you want to go with the Roth IRA structure, it should not be subject to attack because it's the Roth IRA structure.
Okay.
You still have to make sure you cross your P's and dot your I's and making sure that you don't have prohibited transactions and what have you, but the basic structure should be available.
Okay. Well, that is helpful. Well, geez, I can't believe our hour is up already. I could go on for hours. So I tell you what, at this point, how about if we go ahead and wrap up this episode? And would you be available to have a second episode where we really go into detail on some of the different structures and where they're appropriate?
Sure. As I told the Second Circuit, I consider these things as tutorials, so that's fine.
Okay. That sounds great then. So I guess the last question for you, if somebody needs to or you know, wants to reach out to you or is interested in in retaining you, what's the best way for them to reach you? Should they call you or shoot you an email?
Any way they want is fine. They can send me an email. They can call or.
Could you go ahead and repeat or state your phone number and your email address just so they know?
Sure. My phone number is area code 312-861-2937.
Okay.
My email is neal.block at Baker, BAKER, McKenzie, MCKENZIE.com.
Okay. Well, that is great. And I believe from clients of ours that I've introduced to you, am I correct that your policy is such that you're kind of amenable to an introductory, kind of a brief exploratory call that you typically, you know, don't bill for? Is that correct? Or just kind of help me understand what the parameters are if somebody calls you up.
Sure. We don't, there's no problem with a phone call to try and find out whether or not we think what they have is doable and what have you.
Okay.
So, yeah, sure. If it takes all day long, we might want to charge, but
sure.
But half hour of our time certainly is no problem.
That's excellent. Well, I really appreciate your time, Neil, and we'll look forward to the next episode where we get into some of the structure questions. And just a little teaser here, I also will share the story of the most valuable lesson that Neil Block taught me about hiring experts. So we'll save that for that episode as well. Okay. Great. Well, again, thank you very much for your time, Neil. It was really a lot of fun, and I really loved all the war stories. I could just listen to the war stories all day long. So thanks for taking time.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
There we have it, another great episode. Thanks for listening in. If you want to continue the conversation, go to icdiscshow.com. That's icdiscshow.com. And we have additional information on the podcast, archived episodes, as well as a button to be a guest. So if you'd like to be a guest, go select that and fill out the information, and we'd love to have you on the show. So that's it. We'll be back next time with another episode of the IC Disc Show.